Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, it's Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast. It's Tuesday, June 14th. We are so happy that Andrea Bernstein could join us today because she has such a relevant background to make sense of the January 6th committee hearing so far. Andrea, as some of you will remember, co-hosted the WNYC podcast Trump Inc., which was about the relationship between Trump's business interests and the public interest. And yesterday we learned that the big lie may have been tied to a big grift, soaking small donors for $250 million to a non-existent Trump defense fund. Andrea is author of the book American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and the Marriage of Money and Power. Yesterday we learned that even Jared Kushner was working on getting Trump to accept reality and concede. Andrea covered Rudy Giuliani when he was mayor of New York. And Andrea covered Bridgegate for WNYC. Yesterday, we heard central Bridgegate figure Bill Stepien, who was Chris Christie's campaign manager in 2013 when that crime took place, and who was also Trump's campaign manager in 2020. But in his deposition before the committee, Bill Stepien described himself as the captain of Team Normal after Trump lost the election, as opposed to Team Rudy.
I didn't mind being categorized. There were two groups of them. We called them kind of my team and Rudy's team. I didn't mind being characterized as being part of Team Normal, as reporters, you know, kind of started to do around that point in time. I said, you know, hours ago, early on, that, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, 25 years, and I've spanned, you know, political ideologies from Trump to McCain to Bush to Christie, you know, and, you know, I can work under a lot of circumstances for a lot of varied, you know, candidates and politicians. But a situation where, and I think along the way I've built up a pretty good, I hope, a good reputation for being honest and professional. And I didn't think what was happening was necessarily honest or professional at that point in time.
Bill Stepien, who was supposed to testify live yesterday, but his wife went into labor, so they played clips from his earlier deposition, like that one. With me now is Andrea Bernstein, who did all those things I said before and is now co-host of a podcast series about January 6th called We'll Be Wild from Pineapple Street Studios, Amazon Music, and Wondery. Hi, Andrea. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Brian. Great to talk to you.
First, remind everyone why you titled your new podcast series, We'll Be Wild.
Well, We'll Be Wild was in that Trump tweet that he sent out inviting people to come to Washington on January 6th. So he sent it out on December 19th. And for those who may not recall the full tweet, he starts out by quoting a report from Peter Navarro, who was Trump's former trade person, and who I guess, using yesterday's terminology, would seem to have definitely not been on Team Normal. And he starts out by quoting a report by Peter Navarro about vote fraud and then says, big protest in Washington, D.C., January 6th, be there, we'll be wild. So when we named the podcast, we're referring back to that tweet, that moment. I think what has become extraordinarily interesting through both the Justice Department investigations that are going on, the prosecutions of the people who breached the Capitol, who assaulted law enforcement, and through the work of the Select Committee, that tweet was the fulcrum on which this whole thing rested. That when Trump sent out that tweet, there was a vast mobilization across the country of, we know, both people who were, according to prosecutors, involved in the seditious conspiracy cases, and also just regular people we spoke to. We interviewed for our podcast, and we said to them, why did you come to Washington? And they said, the president said, be there. So we came.
We'll be wild. And wild it was, just like we heard testimony that after he said that thing in the debate, against Biden in the 2020 campaign about the Proud Boys, Stand Back and Stand By. Somebody testified that it tripled the Proud Boys membership after that. All right, talk to us about Bill Stepien. How did a guy who was willing to attach himself as campaign manager to the likes of Chris Christie and Donald Trump with the ways they've been willing to campaign, how did Bill Stepien go from Team Bridgegate to Team Normal?
Yeah. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the concept of Team Normal. But to answer your question, and also just to refer back to your introduction, really extraordinary how all of these people that we've spoken about over the years, the Bridgegate figures, Jared Kushner, Chris Christie, Rudy Giuliani, sort of end up in the same room during this incredibly pivotal period in American history, sometimes actually in the same room, sometimes metaphorically in the same room. So to answer your question, Bill Stepien really sort of cut his teeth in New Jersey politics. He was the campaign manager, the campaign strategist. At various points, he sort of ran the Republican Governors Association for Governor Chris Christie. He was deputy chief of staff in New Jersey for Chris Christie. But he was really the sort of brains behind the idea that led to Bridgegate, which was that Chris Christie was going to get such overwhelming support in blue counties in New Jersey that he was going to be the obvious candidate to be the Republican nominee in 2016. That was the strategy, and that was really what Bill Stepien was carrying out, and he had various things. He had a list of towns in New Jersey where he thought that they could get more votes out of Democratic districts. They would dole out favors to the Democrats who played along, like tickets to Giants and Jet Stadium in the governor's box, or bits of steel from the World Trade Center that they would bring to these towns in New Jersey and have ceremonies with the mayors. Wow. So this was the strategy that Bill Stepien had masterminded. It was a strategy that worked well. Christie won re-election overwhelmingly in 2013 and was really poised at that point to be the front runner among Republicans. And then it all unraveled in part, as we know, because of that email, time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee. Bill Stepien was never charged in the scheme, but during the course of the trial, his name was mentioned so many times that at one point I decided to count up how many. It was 351 times his name was mentioned. So he was certainly speaking to the people who were involved in carrying out the scheme. Of course, it needs to be said that the Bridgegate case was taken all the way to the Supreme Court and the charges were thrown out. So nobody has been convicted in that scheme right now. But that is Bill Stepien. The day that email was released, Christie fired him. And there was people who were close to Bill Stepien told me and my colleague Matt Katz that he was extremely upset. He was extremely angry with Christie.
Fall guy.
Betrayed by him.
Fall guy?
Yeah, that he felt like that. And his sort of, career kind of went onto the back burner until 2016 when he went to work for Trump. And that campaign, of course, was not being managed, but being strongly advised by Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law, and also who is, saw someone as Chris Christie as his sworn enemy because Chris Christie had put his father, Charles Kushner, in prison for campaign finance violation, corruption, and witness tampering. So this sort of New Jersey backstory gets Bill Stepien into this position of power, or is one of the reasons why he gets into this position of power with the Trump campaign. And he, does the same kind of stuff he did. He does micro-targeting. He figures out how to move very specific segments of voters. And we all know that Trump won in this incredible upset over Hillary Clinton. And Bill Stepien goes to the White House, becomes the White House political director in 2020. First, he's deputy campaign manager. Then he takes over as campaign manager when Christie, as he does, fired his campaign manager. And as Bill Stepien pointed out in his deposition, that was the worst day of Trump's campaign. According to Bill Stepien, Trump did much better after he came. So Bill Stepien emerges out of all of this as this very powerful but silent figure. Matt Katz, your WNYC colleague, wrote in his book that Bill Stepien was referred to as smoke because now you see him, now you don't. He spoke so little. It was really extraordinary to hear so many words coming out of his mouth.
One more clip. Remember, we heard the bombshell yesterday from Trump senior advisor Jason Miller that Rudy Giuliani was drunk on election night when he advised Trump to declare victory before even the first tally of votes had been counted or the states had been called. In this clip, Stepien and Jason Miller describe how they opposed declaring victory without the election returns. Stepien speaks first.
It was far too early to be making any calls like that. Ballots were still being counted. Ballots were still going to be counted for days. And it was far too early to be making any proclamation like that.
I remember saying that to the best of my memory, I was saying that we should not go and declare victory until we had a better sense of the numbers.
Okay. Can you be more specific about that conversation, in particular what Mayor Giuliani said, your response, and then anybody else in the room's response?
I think effectively Mayor Giuliani was saying, we want it. They're stealing it from us. Where'd all the votes come from? We need to go say that we won. And essentially that anyone who didn't agree with that position was being weak.
That's Trump advisor Jason Miller, the last voice there. And at that time, as Miller went on to testify, Giuliani was drunk. Andrea, you've covered Bill Stepien when you were a reporter on Bridgegate. You covered Rudy Giuliani when he was mayor of New York. Did you ever know Rudy to have a drinking problem while in office?
So I did not see him drinking when he was in office, except for, you know, couple of times during his, you know, ill-fated 2008 campaign for president, where he used to, you know, be fond of staying in, you know, pretty fancy hotels. And the press would stay also in the same hotel with the candidate, is the way it usually works. And, you know, sometimes they would have these sort of lavish steak dinners with, you know, whiskey and cigars and that kind of thing. But I have not seen that. I've heard a number of people who have seen him recently, maybe in the run-up to the 2020 election. This was reporting that I was doing around the time of the first impeachment trial, who reported that they saw Rudy Giuliani apparently inebriated. And there are some, you know, people who were former top New York City officials who, were quite close to him at one point when he was running the government in New York City. And even after, were sort of very much Rudy loyalists who also told me that they had seen that. And some of them told me they had broken with him as a result of that. So I personally did not see it. I felt like many people kept saying it to me. It was interesting the way it came out open in the hearing yesterday and that there were eyewitnesses that evening who said that's what they saw.
Here's a 2-minute clip of the star witness from yesterday, as we all know by now, Trump's Attorney General William Barr, who says he would still vote for Trump again in 2024 if Trump is the Republican nominee. But Barr resigned in December 2020 rather than become part of the big lie that he apparently didn't believe in. And in this videotaped testimony to the committee, Barr describes a day that fall when Trump called him to a meeting after Barr had begun to cast doubt on the stolen election claims.
So I came over to meet with the president in the Oval Office, and Meadows and Cipollone were there. And the president, and this is leading up to this conversation with Kushner, the president said there had been major fraud and that as soon as the facts were out, the results of the election would be reversed. And he went on this for quite a while, as he's prone to do. And then he got to something that I was expecting, which is to say that apparently the Department of Justice doesn't think that it has a role of looking into these fraud claims. So I said, you know, that has to be the campaign that raises that with the state. The department doesn't take side in elections, and the department is not an extension of your legal team. And our role is to investigate fraud, and if and we'll look at something if it's specific, credible, and could have affected the outcome of the election. And we're doing that, and it's just not. They're just not meritorious. They're not panning out. And as I walked out of the Oval Office, Jared was there with Dan Scavino, who ran the president's social media, and who I thought was a reasonable guy and believe is a reasonable guy. And I said, how long is he going to carry on with this stolen election stuff? Where's this going to go? And by that time, Meadows had caught up with me and leaving the office and caught up with me and said that he said, look, I think that he's becoming more realistic and knows that there's a limit to how far he can take this. And then Jared said, you know, yeah, we're working on this. We're working on it.
And Jared said, we're working on this, we're working on it. So that portrays Jared as trying to convince Trump to stand down from the big lie and hearing it as a big lie. But before I get your comment on that, Andrea, here's a clip of Jared himself that the committee played on Thursday from his videotaped deposition to the committee. This one is notable to me for two reasons. One is that Jared is trying very hard here not to distance himself from Trump. But the other is that Jared reveals that Trump was going so far into Planet Delusional that Trump's White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, kept threatening to resign.
Like I said, my interest at that time was on trying to get as many pardons done. And I know that, you know, he was always, him and the team were always saying, oh, we're going to resign. We're not going to be here if this happens, if that happens. So I kind of took it up to just be whining, to be honest with you.
So first, Andrea, what was that about Jared's emphasis at the time on getting as many pardons as possible?
Yeah.
Were they pardons for anyone who may have been right at that time breaking the law by perpetrating the big lie scheme?
Well, I don't know anything about that. But I did do a spit take when I heard that, because who is pardoned in the waning days of the Trump's presidency? Jared Kushner's own father, Charles Kushner.
Ah.
So was Roger Stone. So was Paul Manafort. So was Steve Bannon. So was Elliot Broidy, who had been vice chair of the Republican National Committee. So were a rogues gallery of people committed specifically of corruption. You know, what often happens at the end of a presidency is that, you know, people who have been trying to get their cases overturned, or people on death row who've had new evidence that they're innocent, or people who can't get a fair shake in court, usually sort of, you know, poor people who have not had access to the courts, get pardons. The rich and powerful and many corrupt figures, I mean, Bernie Kerik, got a Trump pardon, although not at that point.
Former New York City police commissioner.
Yes, which it always sort of astounds me that he gets referred to as the former New York City police commissioner when, you know, his sort of final act in public life before he showed up on January 6th was to be also convicted in a corruption scandal. So that is who was getting pardoned at the end of the Trump administration. And I can see why the White House counsel's office was upset, because the Justice Department had worked incredibly hard to bring these prosecutions. And, you know, Mike Flynn was another one. And they were thrown out at the end of the Trump presidency.
And last question, Andrea, for you as co-host of the former WNYC podcast series Trump Inc., about the relationship between Trump's business interests and the public interest, was it new to you yesterday, this thing about raising $250 million for a Trump defense fund that didn't actually exist?
Yeah. Excuse me. Sorry. The specifics of it were definitely new. I mean, I was aware that the Trump campaign and these, you know, various committees around him have been raising money. And in fact, one of the things I looked into deeply for the podcast was this question of disinformation. Disinformation is almost always accompanied by some kind of financial grift, that people put out wrong facts and then raise money off of it. So that is a pattern that, you know, has been tracked by disinformation experts, not only here, but, you know, worldwide. But I think that the level of detail was extraordinary. Something that Representative Lofgren said after the hearings was that Kimberly Guilfoyle, Don Jr.'s girlfriend, received $60,000 for her 2.5-minute speech introducing him at the rally on the Ellipse. So there is, you know, there it is, money going straight from these small donors into the pockets of, you know, people who are in the sort of broadly speaking Trump family. Some money went to Trump hotels. Some money went to Mark Meadows' organization, to other organizations where several former Trump officials have worked. I mean, the contours of it don't surprise me in the least, but the details were absolutely new details, and I'm hoping that over the course of the hearings we learn more.
Well, again, the breaking news this morning, tomorrow's hearing, which was scheduled for 10 o'clock and would have preempted the show tomorrow, has now been postponed. The committee says it's for technical reasons because it takes a lot of time to put together all those video clips and things. We thank Andrea Bernstein, late of WNYC's Trump, Inc. podcast. Now the co-host of the podcast, Will Be Wild, which is all about January 6th. Released by Pineapple Street Studios, Amazon Music, and Wondery. Andrea, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.